Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. This afternoon's topic is titled Courthouse Steps Decision Teleforum, Thrive Inc. versus Click-to-Call Technologies LP. My name is Greg Walsh, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Mr. Daniel L. Geiser, Chair of the Supreme Court and Appellate Practice at Geiser PC. After our speaker gives his opening remarks, we will go to audience Q&A. Thank you for sharing with us today. Mr. Geiser, the floor is yours.
Thanks so much, Greg, and thanks to the Federalist Society for having me. As you may know, I argued this case in the Supreme Court, and it's always great to have a public opportunity to relive one of the most irritating and disappointing decisions of my entire career. But you know, that said, this is an important case, and I'm very happy for the chance to discuss it. I also promise to keep any flushing toilets in the background to a minimum. Thrive versus Click-to-Call on its face is a patent case, but it's really about administrative law and judicial power. The question presented was whether Congress barred all judicial review ever over the Patent Office's interpretation of a key provision of federal law, even though that provision was designed specifically to restrict the agency's own authority. We argued before the court that cutting off Article III authority was squarely at odds with the strong presumption favoring judicial review and bedrock norms in the APA, but the court ultimately rejected our position. And the end result under the majority's reasoning is that Congress delegated the judicial function to an administrative agency, gave that agency unfettered discretion to say what the law is, and then instructed that no Article III court ever, at any time, at any level, may review the agency's interpretation of the statutory limits on its own power. Now, I'm not sure there ever was a time when one would expect that kind of ruling from the Supreme Court, but I certainly didn't expect it from the Roberts Court, which has been highly protective of Article III authority. But that's what happened, and there could be unspoken motivations behind the majority's departure from the recent trend of the court's heavy skepticism of any reading that leaves agencies in charge of saying what the law is. So with that high-level review out of the way, here's a quick summary of the background on a more granular level. As for the basic statutory setup, in 2011, Congress passed the America Invents Act. Part of that act set up a new procedure called inter partes review. And inter partes review created an adjudicative process to take a second look at issues at issued patents. It set up the provisions for inter partes review in Chapter 31 of Title 35, and it goes before a board of Article I judges who review the arguments by a petitioner seeking to strike down the patent and the patent owner seeking to defend its issued patent. There are a few key statutory provisions that are relevant to this case, so I'll give you the language so it makes a little more sense as we go through the discussion. And fair warning that this gets a little dense. The first key provision is in Section 314A, and this is the provision that outlines certain powers that the director has to institute review, and certain limitations on those powers, but not the only limitations on those powers. And what Section 314A says is the director may not authorize an inter partes review to be instituted unless the director determines that there is a reasonable likelihood that the petitioner would prevail with respect to at least one of the claims challenged in the petition. So that sets out the discretionary authority for the director to look at the merits of the petition and decide whether to institute review. It's up to the director. Then if you skip down a few subsections to Section 314D, it says the determination by the director whether to institute an inter partes review under this section shall be final and non-appealable. Now, that's the key provision at issue here that debatably cuts off judicial review. But as we pointed out to the court, the provision is textually limited to the director's determination under this section. And as a side note, Congress separately used the phrase instituting inter partes review under this chapter, referring to all of Title Title 31, that chapter, throughout the rest of Title 31. So one question is, what else is in that chapter? And one thing that you'll find in other parts of the chapter outside Section 314 are limits on the agency's authority to act. It's a strict limit on agency power. These are prerequisites that must be satisfied in order for the agency to exercise review, and indeed even for the director to consider whether to exercise review in the first place. So one of those provisions, and the one that was at issue in this case, was a limitation provision. And it restricted the Patent Office's power to institute review in this way. This is under Section 315B. It says, an inter partes review may not be instituted if the petition requesting the proceeding is filed more than 1 year after the date on which the petitioner is served with a complaint alleging infringement of the patent. So that imposes an absolute textual limit on the agency's power. It was one of the fundamental protections that Congress included in the America Invents Act to protect patent owners from abuse, and it did that by making sure that accused infringers couldn't test the waters in district court, receive unfavorable rulings, and then turn to the agency for a second bite at the apple. That kind of activity is not only profoundly unfair to patent owners, but it's also wasteful of judicial and time party and judicial and party time and resources. So the Supreme Court has confronted the meaning of Section 314D. That's a provision that cuts off some form of judicial review in two prior cases, and those cases debatably reached conflicting results. The first case was the Quozo case, and the question in Quozo was whether the Section 314D appeal bar, again, the same provision that was at issue here, blocked off judicial review of a requirement that a party seeking review state with particularity the grounds for challenging the patent. And the majority opinion in that case was written by Justice Breyer. Justices Alito and Sotomayor dissented, and the majority held that Section 314D did cut off review of that question, whether the petition stated with particularity the grounds for review. It ultimately held that the interpretation and application of any provision, and this is in the court's words, closely tied to institution or involving statutes closely related to Section 314 are barred by judicial review. And at the same time, it noted that interpretive questions that extend, again, in the court's words, well beyond those issues still are subject to judicial review. Now, I'm a huge fan of Justice Breyer's, but I frankly don't have any idea what those restrictions could possibly mean. The idea of something being closely related or closely tied to institution or extending well beyond the institution question, those words are found nowhere in Section 314's plain text or anywhere else in Title 31. It's not clear to me how one would reliably measure whether a legal issue is closely tied to Section 314A. How close is close? The majority didn't really say. When does an issue reach not just beyond but well beyond the director's discretionary institution decision? Again, I'm not sure. The court never really said. And so one argument that we made in our brief, in fairness, I am the losing party here, was that when it comes to jurisdictional statutes, the court typically adopts clear and bright line rules that favor administrability and predictability over vague and obscure boundaries. So in our view, Quozo left what you would think of as vague and obscure boundaries, and it would create confusion in future cases. And indeed, it was no surprise that the court revisited the Quozo test only a term or two later in SAS Institute. In SAS Institute, the court took up a related question under Section 314D, and in doing so, it seemed to textually narrow Quozo. And in that case, the majority, an opinion written by Justice Gorsuch, rejected the government's argument that Section 314D forecloses judicial review of any legal question bearing on the institution decision. So the government tried to argue effectively what they succeeded in arguing in this case, that Section 314D foreclosed judicial review of legal questions bearing on institution. But that position, again, was rejected in SAS Institute, and rejected rejecting it before, the court cited a strong presumption favoring judicial review. And it said that Section 314D, and I quote, precludes judicial review only of the director's initial determination under Section 314A that there is a reasonable likelihood that the claims are unpatentable. So what the court effectively said in SAS Institute is, notwithstanding the broader language in other parts of the Quozo decision, that Section 314D bars off what effectively is the preliminary look that the director takes when they look at a petition and the patent, which makes sense, and it comports with traditional APA principles because those initial decisions are exactly the kind that are usually washed out once the director finally issues a final decision on patentability. It's sort of like trying to get review of a preliminary injunction after the final decision that's adjudicated all the claims, not just guessing about likelihood of success, but actual success or failure, is teed up for appellate review. The court stressed, too, in SAS Institute that the American Invents Act and the 314D appellate bar didn't let agencies act outside their statutory limits, and that the judicial judiciary retains its usual authority to set aside agency action that exceeds its jurisdiction. So that's sort of the very long windup for our case. Here are the very quick facts of how we got here, and it was a long and drawn-out procedural history. I won't bore anyone with the details, which I hope I haven't already done. But the bottom line was that Thrive, who is the petitioner before the Patent Office, had been sued earlier and over a decade earlier by a patent owner before Thrive sought the current inter partes review. And now, when Thrive filed that petition, the PTAB said, the PTAB is the patent board that adjudicates these proceedings, said that Thrive's petition was timely because the earlier lawsuit, even though filed over a decade ago, had been dismissed without prejudice. And so if you remember back to the 314B language, that talked about when someone was served with a complaint. It didn't say anything about what happened after being served. But the Patent Office read that provision to effectively reset where if there's a dismissal without prejudice, then the earlier service of the complaint is wiped out. Now, after multiple trips to the Federal Circuit and a trip up to the Supreme Court where there was a GVR for the earlier decisions, click to call one in the Federal Circuit. And the panel had made two holdings that are relevant here. The first is it said that whether the agency had correctly construed 315B's time bar was an issue that is subject to judicial review. And it held that, citing an intervening en banc decision in a case called Wi-Fi 1. And that was a 7-4 decision by the Federal Circuit. Then the panel in our case held en banc that the agency had misread Section 315B's plain text. As I just said, the panel's logic was pretty straightforward. It was a plain text reading. It said that 315B asked when a complaint was served, not what happened after the complaint was served, and that there was no textual hook for reviving the limitation period whenever a case is dismissed without prejudice. Thrive at that point sought Supreme Court review. In its response to that petition, the government conceded for the first time that the agency's initial reading of Section 315B was wrong, which means that the agency should not have instituted review and did not have the power to strike down provisions of click-to-call's patent. But the government also said that the agency's interpretation, of 315B, which is a freestanding provision of the United States Code, was not subject to any Article 3 review. And that meant, according to the government, that the agency proceeding was instituted in error. The agency had no authority to conduct the proceeding. The agency thus had no authority to strike down the issued patent, and yet no court ever at any time could interpret the meaning of this federal statute or cabin the agency to its lawful authority. And yet the Supreme Court still granted review. So now we advance forward, and I'll skip the oral argument for now to get to the opinion. And, you know, one might think that with the Roberts Court, which, again, is typically very protective of Article III authority, that it would question whether Congress really vested an agency with the unreviewable authority to say what the law is for a federal statute, especially one that constrains agency authority. Yet the court affirmed 7-2 in an opinion the court reversed. This is wishful thinking on my part. Justice Ginsburg wrote the opinion, and Justice Gorsuch, joined only by Justice Sotomayor, dissented. Justice Ginsburg's opinion was quick and tidy work. She's a tremendous writer. She did not go into her characteristic usual painstaking and studious detail on all of the arguments in the case. It was a very short discussion. It had scant reference to the strong presumption favoring judicial review. It didn't really grapple with the difficult textual arguments pointing the other way I'd like to think we pointed out effectively in our brief and at argument, and that Justice Gorsuch certainly pointed out effectively in his dissent. The majority instead focused on a few short points. It first said that Quozo, the first case looking at this provision, already read this statute the way that Thrive and the government were reading it in this case. And so the majority then proceeded to ask whether the Section 315B time bar fell within Quozo's test for how broad the scope of the prohibition on judicial review is. The majority didn't really ask, at least in any detail, whether the provision fell within the actual text of Section 314D, which cuts off review. We weren't too happy with that, because we'd like to think that typically the answer is, or the answer turns on what the statute says, not what the court might say in formulating, you know, a general test designed to resolve a specific issue arising in a past case. But that's how the analysis proceeded in this case. And in looking at that analysis, Justice Ginsburg's opinion suggested that Section 314A governs institution, Section 315B is a limitation on institution, and therefore it must be closely related, again, looking to Quozo's test, with the institution decision. Now that didn't really answer the textual points on the other side. One thing that we pointed out, and that Justice Gorsuch points out, is that Section 314A is discretionary. It's looking at that preliminary merits determination, whether it's reasonably likely to think that a claim is invalid. It's taking that first cut at the question, not the final cut. And under 315B, the director doesn't even have authority to ask that question unless the petition is timely. And if you look at the language of 315B, it's not directed to the director. It doesn't ask him to decide certain things. It simply says that no inter partes review may be instituted. It's an express statutory cutoff of the agency's power, which again strikes us as a pretty different question than the reasonable likelihood determination that is actually captured in Section 314. We didn't see a really convincing answer to the text of 314. Justice Ginsburg doesn't really say why Congress said that the review is the judicial bar on, or the bar on judicial review is limited to decisions of the director under this section, where 315B falls outside this section. The judicial review bar is in 314. 315 is not 314. It's the next section. It's under this chapter, which, as we pointed out, is language that Congress used repeatedly in other parts of Title 31. And we also didn't see really any textual answer for what the words under the section could possibly mean. And in fact, you could read the language, the provision, exactly the same way, whether you include the under the section clause or not. And typically, under bedrock rules of construction, construction or interpretation isn't favored if it renders certain language superfluous. And so the majority also didn't address whether the provision was really ambiguous. Some points that were before the court was that the very first time the scope of 314D was litigated by the government, it was in a district court case. and the U.S. Attorney's Office read the provision to say that judicial review was in fact available once there was a final written decision in a case, that you couldn't look at that initial determination on the merits, but that you could litigate the other provisions arising elsewhere in the chapter. You have the Federal Circuit en banc saying judicial review is available, reading the same section. You have the fact that the dissenting justices earlier in Clozo read the statute not to cut off judicial review. You have the majority in SAS Institute reading the statute not to cut off judicial review. So aside from the textual clues, you have an awful lot of both government litigating positions and actual members of the Article III judiciary reading this text and thinking it doesn't cut off review, and in fact it's not even the best reading of the text to say that it does, which typically is enough under the presumption favoring judicial review to preserve Article III authority, because again, as long as something is reasonably susceptible to a construction that gives Article III courts their usual power to, as Marbury versus Madison said a long time ago, to say what the law is, that's the right way to read that provision. So instead of grappling with those points, Justice Ginsburg's majority opinion instead turned to the purpose and design of the statute and effectively held that Congress crafted this new procedure, this inter partes review procedure, to eliminate bad patents, that there was something unseemly about letting the agency go through the entire process, hold that a patent is invalid, and then permit the patentee to erase that opinion on appeal based on a technicality. So there was something that the majority felt was at odds with Congress's ultimate determination that these bad patents shouldn't be on the books. Now, of course, Congress often tasks agencies with work, and when agencies make procedural errors in conducting that work, sometimes they have to start over. If there's a notice and comment requirement and the agency spends lots of time crafting a very careful regulation, but they never provide notice and they don't ask for any comments, that they're likely will be sent back down by courts to redo that work. And I don't think to me that there's anything unseemly about that. It's just the way that the process is supposed to work. And I think that's consistent, too, with the statutory purpose. One thing the majority didn't really say is how their view of eliminating bad patents squares with Congress's, kind of conflicting but tempering purpose to limit the agency's authority and protect patent owners. The statutory time bar is one of the protections that Congress crafted to make sure that patentees weren't facing duplicative challenges by accused infringers. And the Supreme Court has said countless times that no statute pursues its purposes at all costs. And when Congress has an express balance in the statutory text that and on the one hand, it does try to weed out bad patents, but on the other hand, tries to protect patentees from untimely challenges, it seems to advance the statutory purpose to enforce the statute itself. But again, these arguments didn't carry the day. Now, everything I've said was said far better and far more coherently by Justice Gorsuch in his dissent. And Justice Sotomayor joined the dissent in large part. She was the only justice that joined that dissent. I was a little surprised that Justice Alito didn't join, since Justice Gorsuch was taking the exact position that Justice Alito had taken earlier in Clozo and in SAS Institute. But Justice Gorsuch did keep Justice Sotomayor. Again, it's a tour de force. He broke down the American Vents Act's text, structure, context, purpose. He emphasized the importance of judicial review and in checking unauthorized agency action. He stressed the importance of protecting private property rights from arbitrary and unlawful determinations. And he reminded the reader that back in the oil states case, it wasn't even clear whether an Article I agency has the authority to adjudicate the validity of an issued patent right. You have a private property, which is what a patent grant is, being adjudicated exclusively by Article I judges. And while the court said that didn't offend other parts of the Constitution, Justice Gorsuch, I think, had a pretty fair point. Again, I'm very biased in saying that it's extraordinary to let that Article I process adjudicate these rights and let the Article I agency construe the meaning of a provision of the United States Code that constrains its own authority, and then not let any judicial body at any time, anyone who's actually vested with Article III power, to review the meaning of that federal law. So I'd say the dissent is worth reading in full, and so is the majority opinion, in fairness. I mean, these are tough, tricky issues, and Justice Ginsburg did a good job with it. I just wish she had addressed some of the other points to see how the majority would really answer some of the better arguments on the other side. So now that's a quick summary of the opinion. Now, just to go quickly into the sort of the implications and the oddities from the decision. Now, I didn't talk about the oral argument, but one thing I will say about it is that our case was paired that day with an immigration case, Guerrero Las Pria versus Barr. The immigration case went first, and it also involved a provision that arguably cut off judicial review of an agency determination. And in that hour of argument, I believe that every justice who asked a question emphasized the absolute importance of Article III review, the dangers of vesting Article I agencies, you know, with total authority to say what the law is, how this isn't just a statutory presumption. This strikes at the very core of our constitutional system of governance and the separation of powers, and how important all these principles are. And, you know, as we were sitting there, we were thinking this sounds pretty good for our case. But as it turns out, it was sort of a tale of two arguments. We stand up and immediately what's the big deal? The agency can generally get these things right. The chief asked a funny question about that. This isn't really what we were battling about at Yorktown, which is fair, but at the same time, it's really not fair because the constitutional structure is indeed part of what we were battling about at Yorktown. And whether Article III courts get to construe the meaning of federal law or whether agencies get to construe the meaning of federal law is a pretty big constitutional issue, even if it arises in the backdrop of a patent that, although in our view actually has substantive merit, the patent office thought was issued incorrectly. So now what are the sort of undecided questions left over from the decision? One is that I think it's a pretty safe bet that this will not be Section 314B's last trip to the court. The majority embraced Quozo's test, which is pretty imprecise, which leaves open a lot of questions about what else is cut off from review or isn't cut off from review. There are provisions about who can join ongoing proceedings. Can a party join one of its earlier proceedings to raise new issues that otherwise would be time barred? There are provisions that restrict what a real party in interest can do if they're associated with a petitioner who's time barred. There are lots of different components of Chapter 31 that are pretty tricky, that raise pure questions of statutory construction that might bear on the agency's authority to institute review. And it's really not clear under the majority's test where those provisions will shake out. Another undecided issue, are there alternative paths to getting these questions before the court? The majority hinted at mandamus relief. And so what if you have a situation where the agency says, you know, the Section 315's time bar is wholly optional? Or what if it embraces extensive tolling on the time bar, and novel tolling, you know, a form of equitable tolling no one's ever seen? The Federal Circuit has looked at this in the past and cast doubt on the availability of mandamus review, but it may now be an open question. What do you do about possible freestanding suits under the APA? If the agency adopts, officially an unlawful construction in a way that affects a party in a pending case, can that construction be challenged in district court under the APA? And the DOJ originally said that you couldn't raise that kind of suit, but they did that at the time when they read the appeal bar more narrowly and more modestly and said that patent owners could get review of these questions once a final decision was issued and the case and the agency was done with the case. So a few other quick points that I'll make before turning it over for questions. I would note that I think this is inconsistent with the court's pretty strong recent efforts to curb the actions of executive agencies. You look at cases like Kaiser versus Wilkie and our deference. You have the court questioning whether the agency can construe ambiguities in its own regulations. You have members of the court flagging questions about Chevron deference and whether it's even legitimate to say that courts will defer to an agency's reasonable construction of a federal statute. I mean, you think about cases like PDR Network and the terrific opinions in that case, including the ones that would have taken the decision a little farther. Yet in this case, we're not just talking about deferring to ambiguities in the law and giving the court some role. This is giving the agency sole discretion to construe federal law. It's cutting off the judiciary's role in the process entirely. So it's a little unclear how this decision squares with the Roberts Court's recent trends in those areas, but we'll see. Now, if I had to guess, guessing is always a risky endeavor, I would guess this probably has something to do with patents and the Federal Circuit. The court, in recent terms, has shown that it's no friend to patents that it thinks are bad patents. Now, again, in this case, I think we actually had a very good patent, but this is still a systemic question about what happens if the patent office strikes down some claims in an issued patent, and if everyone now thinks those claims should be struck down, will we permit that patent to survive a little longer? And both the government and the petitioner in this case pretty effectively push those buttons to remind the court of the policy implications of what could be at stake. We had a great amici on our side who wrote terrific briefs trying to stress the importance of inventiveness in American society and protecting patentees from abusive and repetitive challenges before the patent office. But the trends in the court's recent decisions on patents sort of cut the other way. The court has also made a habit of reversing the Federal Circuit in recent terms. So, it's always possible that the strong presumption favoring judicial review simply gave way to the even stronger presumption that the Federal Circuit is always wrong and should always be reversed. So maybe that had something to do with it. It's possible that this case trended on the recent questions about stare decisis. We have the difficulty of what happens when you have language in one earlier opinion here, Quozo, that was sort of chipped away at by a later opinion, Sass Institute. And I'm sure everyone is aware that the court has had some pretty heated battles and other opinions that were issued around this time about stare decisis and exactly when the court can sort of cabin or set aside its earlier decisions. It's possible that maybe this had some effect on the court's decisions. And the last point I'll make for now is that for those who are watching carefully the jurisprudence of Justice Thomas, who typically refuses to let agencies supplant the judicial role in saying what the law is, hinted in a concurrence to the immigration case that was argued the same day as our case. And by the way, that case came out trumpeting the strong presumption favoring judicial review and saying that Article III courts do indeed retain their authority to say what the law is. But Justice Thomas wrote a very interesting concurrence that questioned whether there really is a presumption in favor of judicial review, whether as a matter of statutory construction such a presumption makes sense or whether it's illegitimate. So it'll be interesting to see how his views evolve on those questions, especially given the sort of the push and pull of, on the one hand, being very careful to ensure Article III authority over agencies, but on the other hand, possibly thinking that there isn't a thumb on the scale of preserving Article III authority when you're construing federal law. And so with that, I'd say it's probably a good time for questions.
It doesn't look like we have a caller in the queue, so can I exercise my host's prerogative and ask one myself?
Of course you can.
Thank you. Could the rejection of judicial review impact innovation and product development negatively, or is there any way to project that kind of repercussion?
I think it could in the sense that companies invest tremendous amounts of resources to get an issued patent, and it takes a lot of work. And once they get that patent, and then they start investing, you know, in manufacturing lines to implement it, and you know, all sorts of other things related to their private endeavors, to have the patent thrown back for a second look before the agency, you know, can cast doubt on the reliability of the initial investment. And when you have situations where someone is debatably infringing upon a patent, they're sued in district court, and sometimes even invalidity decisions are litigated in court. And then where the party can, you know, after, you know, spending up to a year, and in this case, you know, waiting over a decade after original lawsuit, try to go back to the agency to relitigate those patentability questions, that certainly could have a chilling effect on a company's willingness to put in the funds necessary to come up with really innovative, you know, medical breakthroughs, technological breakthroughs, and everything else. Whether it's possible really to quantify exactly how that plays out, I don't know. But that my sense is that Congress included the provisions like 315B protecting patent owners for a reason. The bill faced a lot. The American Invents Act was heavily scrutinized by all stakeholders on, you know, both sides of these questions, and Congress tried to balance their interests. So I think a ruling that says that the Patent Office, you know, which is obviously doing its very best to get these questions right, but sometimes, as they've now admitted here, they got these questions wrong, and were applying the wrong construction for a long time. That chips away at the protections that Congress inserted in the statute to protect patentees.
Dan, considering the Patent Office, that the agency is far from infallible, is the only recourse for patent owners in the future to try and get more legislation passed or more protections? Is it all purely in out of the court, I guess?
Yeah, I think it may or may not be. I mean, as I suggested, it's theoretically possible that patentees could pursue mandamus relief in the federal circuit. They could try to bring freestanding APA suits if those have faced problems in the past. Both of those options have been shot down in the past. And for some questions, they can still litigate and say that, you know, for whatever reason, whatever the particular protection at issue is, it falls outside Quozo's, you know, atextual and you know, version of 314D. So I do think there still are options for patentees, but the safest option would be legislation, either reaffirming that Article III courts do indeed have the authority to say what the law is, or at least to clarify exactly what is barred by 314D and what isn't. And you know, as usual, the Congress obviously tries its best, and these are complex and difficult questions to write. But you know, the inter-parties review scheme isn't perfectly written. There actually is no provision anywhere that affirmatively grants the Patent Office authority to institute review. It simply sets out things that when review can't be instituted, it places certain conditions on when review can be instituted, but there's actually no provision that says the Patent Office has the authority to institute inter-parties review. So this is far from a perfectly written statute, and I think if Congress went back and clarified, you know, the usual Article III role in the separation of powers, it would make more meaningful the protections that they textually included in the American Invents Act.
Dan, was there anything about the opinion that threw you off in particular?
You know, these are hard questions, and I think a lot of people, now that we're through it, I think I can safely say predicted that this was a case that would be tough for us to win. I was hopeful that we could pull it out just looking at the Roberts Court and how they usually are very protective of Article III authority. I do think it's fairly extraordinary to say that the agency gets to construe the meaning of a provision of the U.S. Code designed to constrain agency power. That that's, you know, kind of letting, it's letting the agency define, you know, sort of the limits on its own review. And I thought that there were different ways that we could count to five and get a majority to say that. I was a little surprised that the opinion didn't go into a little more detail trying to refute what at least we thought were pretty good arguments on the other side and points in Justice Gorsuch's dissent. But of course, you know, the court is busy, and it certainly wrote, you know, a very capable opinion that adequately decides the questions. I do think because it relied on an earlier test that is imprecise and sort of wiped out SAS Institute's attempt to sort of clarify and narrow that test so it provides more of a bright, administrable line that we're going to see future cases trying to figure out what happens next. And so I was a little surprised to see a resolution where one of the main reasons for taking up this case in theory is to reconcile Quozo and SAS Institute, and to do so in a way that won't invite, you know, the fourth battle over this provision. But I'm guessing that unless the court decides it's had enough, or unless Congress fixes it, that we will see a fourth case in the near future.
Well, I hope you get signed up to be able to handle it then.
Well, it'd be great to get another crack at it.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our speaker for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.